Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann. My guest for this episode is Christopher Shine, a permaculture designer and teacher from the Bay Area of California, who recently co-authored the book, The Vegetable Gardener's Guide to Permaculture, Creating an Edible Ecosystem. In this episode, we discuss his book from the context of how he got involved with writing it, working with a publisher, and the process of why and what got included in the final product. We also talk about his role as a teacher at Merritt Community College, where he's taught for 11 years, and graduating what seems like an astounding 700 PDC students over that time, as well as the way that he approaches the class as a hands-on endeavor, serving as another model for teaching permaculture. We also talk about the permutations and changes coming as permaculture continues to grow and mature. My wife introduced me to Christopher and his work when a group she's a part of received a list of upcoming books, which included The Vegetable Gardener's Guide to Permaculture. Doing some research on Christopher, I soon realized that he came from a place of knowledge and experience with the material, so the book sounded interesting, as it was written by someone so steeped in the design and practice. That caused me to reach out to him for an interview, as well as to his publisher, for an advanced copy of the book to read in preparation. Even though my copy was an uncorrected proof, the material stood out solidly, and I liked it. I'll give you a longer, though still brief, review of the book after the interview, so stay with me for that. If you would like to learn more about Christopher, you can find him at his personal website, wildheartgardens.com, or at the Merritt College Landscape Horticulture website, merrittlandhort.com, or at Timber Press, where you can pick up a copy of the book, timberpress.com. And, of course, links to all of this and many other resources are included in the show notes. In the meantime, if you enjoy this or any other episode of the Permaculture Podcast, stop by the website and click on the Support tab. There you'll find ways to donate to the show. It'll really help. Also, share your favorite episodes on Facebook, or if you follow me on Twitter, retweet the updates for new shows, or anything else that I put out there that you like, and help me spread this wonderful system of regenerative design and its many practitioners and topics around the world. I hope you enjoy this time with Christopher as much as I did. And now on to the interview. Well then, Christopher, if you can give us a little bit about your background and how you came to permaculture, and then we can move into discussing your recently released book.
Thanks, Scott. Yeah, so I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and grew up in a townhouse in a large community. It was about 44 acres with 450 units, and we had about 10 acres of open space woods right next to us of hickory and oak and, you know, kind of southeastern Michigan, former swampland. And it was just real suburban kind of thing. And by the time I was 18, I got hired on to the landscaping crew to maintain the lawns and trees and whatever. So $5 an hour kind of unskilled labor. So now I'm doing my own landscaping business. So it's kind of interesting to keep that thread. But anyway, my path to permaculture was through my mother, that she was a gardener when I was growing up, just always having a vegetable garden and herbs and flowers and pretty extensively gardening around the neighborhood right around the immediate townhouse where we grew up. And so that was a big influence on me. And she was part of some community gardens in the complex where we lived. So getting exposed to that and remembering some of the abundance as a kid in the summer of getting so many zucchinis at the community garden that we'd put them in a wheelbarrow and wheel them around and kind of put them on people's back porches kind of thing. Like, you know, what do you do with so many zucchinis? So just seeing that there's a lot of productivity and abundance and whatnot. So yeah, then just having some sort of connection, but not huge, and to agriculture and growing food and building community, and then going to UC Santa Cruz as a college student and coming across the Alan Chadwick Agroecology Farm and Garden Program as a student. And I was a work-study student, and so I was, for the first year, taking all the compost from the cafeterias and dropping it off at the student farm, which is right next to the campus where I was at, and kind of getting my mind blown and open to new possibilities of just beautiful organic agriculture in this idyllic setting in Santa Cruz in the hills. And they had wonderful cut flower gardens and 200 kinds of apple trees and all kinds of diversity of vegetables, and just, you know, young people doing it and very exciting. And thinking this is, you know, this is what I want to do. And so I kind of just explored that and helped out in the farm and kept spreading the compost the whole 4 years I was a student there. So yeah, for me, permaculture and really thinking about the soil building and all that kind of stuff as the entryway into regenerative agriculture and permaculture and sustainable agriculture kind of things. Just a wonderful model, and seeing that and then getting inspired and wanting to do that kind of thing, and ended up having my senior thesis on this project called Detroit Summer, where for 4 summers I went out to Detroit and helped out with urban farms, urban gardens, and community-based projects, and really getting my mind expanded of possibilities of different cities and different ways of being and things like that. So learning from elders in Detroit how to grow food and just sharing it and getting young neighborhood kids involved and working with kids from across the country to make the gardens happen. So that was really where I got the social justice idea of, oh, you can farm, but it's not just going off to the countryside and providing food for urban people. It's getting urban people or wherever you are involved in your food production. So Detroit Summer is still a project that's going on many years later, like 15 or 16 years later, and really inspiring urban food production kind of thing. But that really got me the idea that I could do sustainable organic agriculture in different communities and bring it to wherever people are living, if it's the city, the suburbs, or rural areas, and a sharing kind of thing. So then I finished college and wrote my thesis about it, and then spent 3 years in Oakland and Berkeley, with started this group with some friends called Spiral Gardens, and in 3 years' time, we built about 12 community gardens, all different kinds, and we never owned a single one of them. And, you know, being young and in the radical tradition, we were squatting gardens and doing it in church gardens, as whoever would let us have access to land, people's backyards, and every time making them into neighborhood centers, people learning how to garden together, having weekly work parties at the different gardens and training people and getting neighbors involved. And we never really got much grant money. We tried, but it was about almost 20 years ago when we were doing this, and just being young and idealistic, we managed to do Food Not Bombs at the same time. So we'd get a lot of free produce and just living really inexpensively, and just that spirit. And some of those gardens are still going, and the organization is still going in a different manifestation. Yeah, there's something really cool about getting people together and sharing food and sharing work and sharing skills in a really decentralized way. And so I did that for 3 years, and then felt like, gosh, I need some more training and more experience in this on a bigger scale with some more professional folks. So that led me up to Linnea Farm in British Columbia, and it's a wonderful 100-year-old plus small homestead on 300 acres, and now it's run by a land trust. There's 3 or 4 families that run a teaching farm, and it's a permaculture-oriented place. And so Liz Richardson and Brent Howie are the two permaculture teachers up there, and they're still teaching. And David Buckner was the main ecological gardening teacher, is what he called it. And so I had a really good time up there, learned even things like blacksmithing and cob building, and, you know, just really expanded my concept of permaculture. Where they had agroforestry, and because they had 300 acres, so we had an acre student production farm where we sold food on the island of Cortez, and, you know, they had cows and horses and sheep and orchards from the 1930s and orchards from the 1950s, and just seeing how different times of modern agricultural practices, you know, just the homesteading from the 30s, how those trees, those varieties were, and how well they were doing. And then the plants from the 50s, you know, a little bit more chemically based, and trees not performing as well, and those kind of things. Anyway, but just a really wonderful experience, because they also had an acre, a little less than an acre, but a student farm that was separate from the production farm, and we just had our own plots and had a couple afternoons a week where we could really get our hands dirty and experiment with kind of whatever we wanted, and just the integration of the fruit trees and all this, you know, this wonderful production farm and animals and agroforestry and a big lake. So just really an idyllic place in a really affordable ecological gardening program and a whole 8-month permaculture immersion, milking goats and cows, and later they got pigs and all that kind of stuff. So really seeing that, and it was just really interesting coming out of the urban spiral garden thing and going to this rural thing where, you know, I'd been involved with Food Not Bombs. And so by the end of my 3 years there, I was like a hardcore vegan and stuff and growing as much food as I could in urban lots. And then kind of getting my mind really expanded and opened at Linnea Farm, like, oh, look, here's this really sustainable food system with animals, and really changing my tune on being a vegan and sustainability in that sense. And so I was up at Linnea Farm for a year, and then, a long story, I did some homesteading there and worked on a farm for a few months, a CSA down in California, but the farm didn't really work out as a community model, and so went back to Cortez Island and homesteaded on a friend's land in a nice community, and then came back down to the United States and landed at UC Berkeley. They have a 5-acre lot. It used to be much bigger, but Gill Track, and it's a really large agricultural demonstration site, and found that the previous farm program had kind of fizzled out on 1 acre, and they needed a volunteer coordinator, so I started doing it for about 2 years or something, helping to train UC Berkeley students in sustainable agriculture practices and agroecology program, and donating food to the students that were working it, and growing seeds for some seed companies, and donating the food to Food Not Bombs, just an organization that has low-income people, homeless people, just activist folks in a very public places, feeding people in the community matter. So trying to get the local food production thing happening. And so all this time I hadn't really focused anything on trying to make a living in it. I was doing it all kind of volunteer style and just living super cheap, and then realized, gosh, I want to get some more permanent. So then I started doing some landscaping so I could buy some food and all this stuff, because it is something that you need to do and when you're not at a rural farm kind of thing. So anyway, I just started saving up money and doing edible landscaping. Started my own business, Wild Heart Gardens, where I just a self-employed urban gardener. And then that was over 15 or 16 years ago. And I've helped do that and other organizations start lots of urban community gardens, school gardens, and this kind of thing. And so that's just kind of been my bread and butter. And the kind of model that I kind of landed on was that one day a week I would work in a community garden and work with different nonprofits trying to do sustainable agriculture, permaculture education demonstrations. And so different organizations came and went, and I helped start a seed library with some friends, which is still going on now. It's a really great thing called BASIL, Bay Area Seed Interchange Library. And about 11 years ago, I had the wonderful opportunity. I was helping in one of these community gardens at the Lakeside Community Garden in Oakland, at a community garden. There's a woman, Claudia Joseph, who ran a permaculture demonstration garden in this bigger community garden, and we're helping her out. She said, hey, my husband got a job in New York City. He's a music composer, and I started teaching this permaculture class at Merritt College, which is a local community college, and I'm moving, and you seem like you know about permaculture, and do you want to teach it? I was like, well, I've done small little, you know, one-day, three-hour workshops or something, and what the heck, I'll just try it and see what happens. And it's been 11 years, and it's been pretty amazing. We've, with students, transformed over an acre on a hillside and have over 300 varieties and species of really interesting fruit trees, nut trees, all food production kind of things. And don't know the exact number, but there's probably about 700 students, roughly, that have come through the program. And what really makes it an exciting program is it's on a big scale, and it's over 10 years, so the food forest is still developing. And, you know, it's had deer and gophers and wild turkeys, whatever. It's on a big site next to a big wilderness area, and so we have plenty of problems up there that we're learning how to deal with. So on a big scale, people can really grasp and grog what permaculture is all about and really get their hands dirty. And it's at a community college, so there's a few other community colleges across the country that are starting to pick up some permaculture programs, but It's a full PDC, permaculture design certificate program. So it just makes it special and makes it very affordable and very accessible. And that's what's kind of been my mission. Even in my first few years, I couldn't really afford a permaculture class. And then, you know, finally saving up and making the great program at Linnea Farm, and then realizing, gosh, this is just so exciting. This information is so great, and it's so needed out in the world. Let's just transform our industrial agricultural-based system into something much more regenerative and decentralized and more empowering, where people can really get into it kind of thing. And so Merit's has been a great vehicle. I've had tons of people come through, and then they've been able to start their own classes at Merit and go on and start other permaculture businesses and teaching and whatever. And there's, you know, school gardeners and all kinds of folks who've come through it. And I feel like I've learned a ton from the students and really getting networked with amazing community-based folks that are willing to share their information on rainwater or gray water or heirloom fruit trees, or, you know, how to graft a fruit tree, or just this kind of stuff. So it's at a landscape horticulture community college. It's on a 7-acre campus, but that's, you know, including the parking lots and the buildings and all this stuff and other classes, landscaping projects. So we're just on the one area of that, but still, it's just really substantial and really fun to see something that was just not really grown on a big scale. So Merit's really exciting. I've just kept the Wild Heart Gardens as something that is my bread and butter and done. I haven't kept the exact record, but definitely over 100 gardens for people's backyards and other, you know, community projects. I'll mention some of those things later. And
it certainly gives us a well-rounded perspective on the place that you come from. That early grounding in gardening with your mother is this narrative thread that leads us all the way from that point and her teaching you and working with you up to your current work. I'm happy to hear that not only about the program at Merit, but that other community colleges like the Austin Community College or like Oregon State University has a permaculture design certificate course that are being offered, that these options are becoming available for people who can't necessarily afford that direct out-of-pocket PDC, or because of the time requirements of like an intensive or some of the others, that these other models for the education are becoming available. The story that you weave for us also gives a good direction for why you would write a permaculture book for a vegetable gardener with your history. That's just me reading into it. What was your motivation to write your book?
Yeah, that's a great question. In 2010, I was just getting back from a family trip to Guatemala for a month, exploring permaculture stuff down there. I got an email from Timber Press, a great gardening press company, saying, hey, we've heard about your work through Merit College and other places, and would you like to write a vegetable gardener's guide to permaculture? I was like, sure, you know, not knowing anything about the writing process and the publishing world and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, so I was really honored, and kind of how that thread came to me was this guy, Blair Randall, in San Francisco, who's been running the Garden for the Environment. It's a teaching garden, nonprofit environmental center in San Francisco, where they teach lots of folks composting and basic organic gardening stuff and have workshops on permaculture, seed saving, or rainwater harvesting, whatever. But anyway, so they've taken tours of Merit and some of my different projects, usually in my backyards, over the last 10 or 12 years with different teachers before him. But they're just like the scale and the style, and hey, this is kind of different. And this looks good. It's productive. It's really low work. Let's bring our students over every year and show them to their Get Up program. Timber Press had contacted him. Hey, do you know any Bay Area permaculture teachers? He said, hey, Christopher Schein has a great farm program and garden program and has been teaching a long time. And why don't you see if he wants to write a book? And I'm definitely an idealist and had no idea what I was getting into and the amount of work it was. So anyway, but I did it. Just another background kind of thing is that in 2007, I had my first daughter, Gitanjali, and then in 2011, we had our second daughter, Bija Sol. I'm kind of, with a lot of folks, been joking that I kind of had two babies in 2011 because I was working furiously on the book and these have blessed our life. And anyway, had to keep working on the book. But yeah, it was kind of like having several large life-changing events. But anyway, so why to frame it in the terms of A Vegetable Gardener's Guide to Permaculture, Timber Press, and I had lots of conversations about it in the beginning. So in 2010, I ended up writing about four different proposals to them because they wanted something very specific. And so at first, I just outlined a basic PDC, kind of what I was doing at Merit and the things I'm passionate about, you know, the web of life and some native plants and zone five stuff. And so a little bit of that did trickle into the book, but, you know, they did want to keep a laser focus on the Vegetable Gardener's Guide. So we went back and forth a number of times. And after the second proposal, and I got a lot of community support. I asked a lot of people to help me with the writing process. And they said, hey, you're obviously very passionate about it and you have a lot to say about it, but your writing style is too academic or things like that. And then they said, why don't you pair up with a writer that just helped us with another book, Julie Thompson. And so that's where she came in, and she's a San Francisco professional writer. And so I did the writing and she did the editing. We pulled it together, and she's not a gardener and she's becoming one. I did a trade with her for some of those proposals in the beginning where I built her a raised bed and did a little garden consulting in her rental place in San Francisco. And so she started growing food all of a sudden while she's learning about this. And so it was a really good pairing that Timber Press really wanted the permaculture book for people that were beginners or people that were experienced organic gardeners but hadn't really taken a PDC and were like, well, what is permaculture kind of thing? So opening for either experienced folks or total novices, but so really very accessible, very approachable styles, what Timber Press was very clear about. And that's kind of how I've always taught permaculture. So it was a good fit. So then the whole focus is on creating edible ecosystems, and I, through my various proposals in the beginning, had to keep explaining to them it would be a little difficult for me to write a book on just solely vegetables to explain permaculture because it's so much more dynamic, and you'd want to think about more than just vegetables. I mean, we need lots of vegetable gardens, and we need them close to home, and some of those kind of basic layout things, and how to some of the, just the techniques of them are definitely permaculture, but I wanted to put it in the context of, hey, we're going to teach about fruit tree guilds, we're going to teach about food forests and succession and layering. And they also were very clear that they didn't want some of the traditional permaculture language, like stacking. They're like, well, let's just edit that out, which I think is great and it makes so much sense, but they just wanted to not have people lost in any of the permaculture language. So that's why we really did simplify lots of things, and the book is not a full PDC. There's a few things that aren't fully addressed, but with Timber Press, you know, they have a whole other books, and anyway, there's other presses too for plenty of great prior permaculture books, but this is just, you know, how is a backyard gardener or a front yard gardener, or are you urban and you're just growing on a balcony or a rooftop, or you're growing in a community garden, or are you suburban and you have a big acre, and what are you going to do with it? How are you going to lay it out? Or even on a farm, like how are you going to start integrating some permaculture concepts to this stuff? So some of those earlier proposals were thinking like, okay, you know, I'm urban and we're just going to write an urban permaculture book. But then as we got into it, Julie was saying, hey, so my friends are suburban and this stuff, they don't know anything like this. Let's reach out to them and let's reach out to some rural people in bigger scale. So it's really about, mostly about zone one and two gardening, some zone three, not a large emphasis on the zone four and five because not everybody has that, but it explains what those concepts are and how to integrate this in. But it's really putting most of the energy in the closer to home kind of gardening style and how you can integrate an edible ecosystem kind of thing. So yeah, that's why the format is, you know, lots of large pictures, little sidebars, and little, you know, how to make compost tea or how to make a seed ball, how to make an A-frame. It's like lots of small takeaway how-to projects in it, as well as lots of extensive, like, oh, here's a whole catalog of annual vegetables, you know, warm season and cool season annual vegetables and perennial vegetables and why it's important to grow them and why it's important to integrate vegetables with fruit trees, with native plants and just beneficial insect attracting plants, you know, like having comfrey is such a cool permaculture teaching tool because, you know, it's got that huge mineral rich leaf mass that it just can make in our climates. Like I'm about 12 times a year or more, you can cut it down and put it as just direct sheet moss tucking under some straw. You can put it in water and make a compost solution out of it, a direct compost tea, or you can oxygenate it and make aerated compost tea. Comfrey is also really good for bringing in native bumblebees with the flowers. It's also a nutrient accumulator. It's got a deep taproot, and so it pulls up nutrients and makes them available to the other plants. So just showing that there's not just one use for a plant. We don't want to isolate things. We want to integrate. Going back to, I really like the newer David Holmgren principles, you know, thinking about integrate rather than segregate. And that's kind of what our modern agriculture and landscaping has done, where, you know, there's farms out in the country, there's ornamental grass lawns around where we live, and ecology is something that during the summer you might go camping in Yellowstone or something, and that's ecology kind of thing. So it's so divorced, so little box categories and stuff. And, you know, what we want to do with permaculture is say, hey, permaculture is about a blend of agriculture and landscapes and ecology right where we are on whatever scale we are. You don't even have to own your own home. You don't have to have any land. You can do it on a neighbor's land if you don't have your own land, or do it in a community garden, or start a school garden, or participate in a community-supported agriculture program, a farm in your community. So, you know, there's all these ways that you can, you know, volunteer on farms and stuff so you can get involved.
I've talked about the importance of getting involved in some of the lectures that I've given on permaculture here locally, that if it's not something you are ready to do right now, there are plenty of programs and organizations and ways to make a difference in your own community. Even if you're not going to run out and take a PDC or start reading the designer's manual, you can functionally and effectively make changes every day to live closer to those ethics and principles that are presented, those, you know, 15 points, the three ethics and the 12 principles, to move your life forward. It was your integration of not only the permaculture material, because there were certainly some places where things got a little bit heavier in some areas, especially when you were, the one that stands out at the moment in my memory was about swales and how you can't just guess contours, you have to measure. So here's an A-frame and here's how to do it. But one of the other things that really caught me was the integration of both the visible and the invisible sides of permaculture, because throughout the entire book, you're weaving these stories of neighbors and organizations that are doing different things to bring people together towards agriculture, towards more sustainable communities. And of course, seeing pictures of your daughter and your wife in the book, and the little pieces of yourself that you include that bring it together and personalize it in a way to know that there was someone there at the other end of all of this writing a book that is for people in those situations and in those communities.
That's definitely how we're trying to do it, because the permaculture books that you read are so inspiring. I remember when I first came across the Introduction to Permaculture book by Phil Mollison and Manny Miaslea from Australia. It's just so exciting. And, you know, they have like a global tour of different, you know, here's dry, arid climates, here's temperate climates, whatever, just permaculture around the world. Like, wow, this is so exciting. Here's what they're doing in traditional farming systems in Brazil and Vietnam and Native American systems and whatever, just like all over, like so exciting. And then it's like, well, here's my little plot with my hens. How do I make that happen? And so I read that book like five times, and just each time I got a different layer of information. I was like, wow, this makes so much sense, as I was working in these community gardens and trying out different things. And you can just keep reading the designer's manual again and again, and it's a great reference. And so, you know, those are really, really great, but they're not necessarily North American. And then, you know, Gaia's Garden, my mom gave me that book years ago when it first came out. She read it. She's like, hey, this is this great permaculture book. And I was like, I don't know, I haven't really heard of it. And I read it, and I was like, wow, this is why everybody likes it. This is so exciting. This is like North American permaculture, and he's such a great articulate writer, and you can really get lots of depth into permaculture systems and all that kind of stuff. And but this was really trying to bring it down to more of a home scale, not looking at some of these longer established permaculture institutes and whatnot, which are great and they're much needed around the country. But this was just kind of like, hey, how can you do this on a really small scale? How can you just integrate this anywhere? Yeah, that's where that came through. And then just about some of the stories about my own garden, it was just so fortunate where I've been now for 6 years in South Berkeley, 6,700 square foot lot, but there's driveways and sidewalks and house and outbuilding and things like that. So it's not all growing space. Now, wife, I was just dating her the first year I was kind of coming around here. So that was about 7 years ago. You know, it was just such a funny thing to see the yard. It was just such a conventional landscape. And I had taken a landscape design class at Merritt College. And, you know, just in the book, they had this picture from Ohio. The authors were from Ohio where they had a big lawn and some shade trees on the edges and an ornamental flower bed separating a vegetable garden. That's exactly what this garden I had inherited where my wife Runa was living had. And I hadn't really seen anything that was so classic of just traditional landscape where vegetables are ugly and they're untidy and things like that, and put them as far away. So the backyard's about 75 feet, the back fence from the stairs. So that's just one of those things where they put the vegetable garden far, far away, and then had a big lawn and some shade trees and flowers. And then I realized, oh, one of the ornamental flowers was Echinacea purpurea, which is a great medicinal and great insectary plant and stuff. So, you know, as we redesigned it when I moved in a year later, that came much closer. So there's an herb spiral and, you know, the vegetables from the back corner. It was shaded during the winter for about 3 months, never got any sun. It was too far away in terms of zones of frequency of use. So in the wintertime, you wouldn't really go out 75 feet when it's dark or it's raining or something. And there's buildings around it, so it never got light. So it was just a bad placement. Going back to one of these permaculture things, that it's just good common sense how we do a lot of the design. And so just by having not living here, I didn't really do anything for a whole year. I was just, you know, helping out and pulling some weeds here and there and making a few suggestions, but not really making any changes to it and being able to observe here's some flooding that's happening. And so then I moved in with her and we quickly had our daughter Gitanzi. And so in that process of being grounded here, I had a whole year to observe it before really doing any changes. And that's just such a great permaculture thing that they talk about in the books, and it's really so hard to do if you're not wanting to just start and make mistakes. And that's another permaculture idea, that you learn from your mistakes. But anyway, so then I was able to put the vegetables much closer and put a food forest in and put the chickens in the far back and extensive composting in the far back of the yard. Really just put the principles to use. That's also another thing of having been urban and started so many different gardens, that the more I start, then the easier it got, and then the design kept evolving and changing. And, you know, it's a garden where we just sheet mulch the lawn and didn't do any digging, and the ornamental trees we cut down and put into log raised beds, and we've grown several crops of mushrooms on those trees, and now they've all decomposed after 7 years, and we put new logs down and not logs in some places and whatever. But, you know, just in the yard putting wood chips down, I got a lot of connections with local arborists. I've sort of kept loose records, but it's about 95 yards of wood chips in 6 years that we keep applying to the paths and whatnot in the entire yard. And so it's building beautiful fertility and making a giant sponge, so all the rainwater is captured and stored in the soil. That's a really big permaculture idea. So, yeah, just, you know, making the backyard real. And so I call this the Permaculture Institute of the East Bay. A friend came up with the name PIE. So that's kind of just my backyard. And yeah, it's showing people how we can do it.
I really love your passion for this material, Christopher, because it comes through in this interview with you and our conversation and the places that you've taken us, both with your early origins through to this book and why you wanted to create something that was so accessible. And I think that you've done so very well while also including permaculture in that material in a way that works. As someone who's been doing this for a while now and having read so many different books on permaculture and reworked some of my own personal designs several times, I realized that very often it's easy to be too steeped in the material when I'm reviewing something or reading something. And it took me a little bit when I first read through your book to recognize that and go, okay, let's read this from the perspective of someone who's not familiar with this, and letting go of some of the places that I've been as a practitioner and in my work with permaculture. And in doing so, it really connected with me. I really enjoyed it. And I thank you and your co-author for your work in putting this together. And I'm glad that Timber Press reached out to Blair and that he pointed us to you, because it's a great place to come from, and your love and expression of this. Is there anything else that you'd like to add to this conversation for the listeners about your work or the book, or just anything that they should consider and take away?
Sure. A couple of small things. I'd like to speak a little bit more about my experience at Merritt College. Another thing that's also important is just how to buy the book. So Timber Press is the publisher, so timberpress.com. You can find it from them, and wildheartgardens.com. I'm reworking my website, so by next week it'll be up, and I'm trying to do some weekly updates kind of thing on that. Those are some good resources to follow that, and I'm going to try to put together a book tour this year. I haven't really done it yet, but the book is just coming out in February, so it will come. So that's how you can find out some more information. And yeah, then about Merritt College, yeah, we just have a PDC at a really accessible community college and really accessible land and a really fun format where it's a three-unit college class. And so the idea is that there's about 60% of the class is hands-on, so their students are broken up into small groups and given different sections of the student farm. Each semester, they get to learn about these concepts of food forests and understories and overstories, and, you know, what's missing, what's working, what's failing, how can we do it better, building new beds, harvesting lots and lots of food, and the students get to take it home, and then abundant food is given to some local nonprofit food shelters. And so it's just really participatory, really hands-on, really a grassroots kind of permaculture class, and been a lot of fun to be a facilitator of it. It's really beautiful, and we have a website, merrittlandhort.com, that people can explore that, and the students kind of slow on the technology front, and definitely been passionate about being outdoors and being connected to the earth, the whole earth care thing, really getting grounded and whatnot is really what I'm passionate about, not being in front of a computer all the time. Still, it's the modern reality. And so anyway, I'm learning about blogging and all this kind of stuff. And so my students years ago were already blogging and set up a whole thing for the class and had different permutations of that. But anyway, through that website, you can find the students' work. And so the student design groups will post what they've learned and what they've done and their project. And this past semester, there's a U.S. Labor Department grant to Merritt College. Then we got to work with a whole other PDC, working with just ex-convicts and unemployed people. So kind of people that haven't really been taking permaculture classes. And they got to garden, and they got to learn about all this stuff and take food home and really get their minds expanded. And because it was a different class, you know, I was able to, instead of having 35 or 40 people, just having 9, I could really focus on one group. We didn't really need to break up into groups, and we were able to, you know, even harvest some chickens that had stopped laying from my yard, is something I wouldn't really do with a bigger class. But, you know, just having fun and just really going back to one of my missions with permaculture is making it as affordable and accessible to as many communities, as many people. So then they can start in their own communities just to be an incubator and then see what happens. So they're going to probably start some edible landscaping businesses in different communities and things like that. And there's all kinds of really amazing, in the East Bay where I live, lots and lots of nonprofit groups that are doing wonderful work, like People's Grocery and City Slicker Farms and Fat Beats Produce, even more, Planting Justice. So there's groups that are all doing things where doing urban farms where they're I'm getting on bigger and bigger scales. Like Fat Beats and some other groups just got 10 acres. They're starting to work with some immigrant communities and really producing food on a bigger scale and starting farmers markets in neighborhoods that traditionally haven't had them, and having wholesale prices for organic food in low-income communities of color, which is kind of like these new things, and working with local hospitals where they've gotten doctors to realize, hey, there's like really big food crisis and there's all this media about obesity, media attention about obesity and whatnot. And so Fat Beats, for instance, works with Children's Hospital and a community garden, interesting, at the old Merritt College in Oakland, but we moved to a new site in the 70s. But anyway, it's a big city lot, and they work with kids in an obesity clinic, and the kids learn how to grow food and do sheep mulching and plant fruit tree guilds and, you know, do this kind of stuff. And then they make food from the plants that they've been tending right there, and then learn about healthy eating. This is how we get health. And then they started farmers markets at the Children's Hospital. So it's just this kind of really great social justice gardening work, and it's happening on a bigger and bigger scale, and it's not just in the East Bay, it's everywhere, but we just have many, many projects that are like this here, and just really looking towards employing youth and really getting this to younger folks and making it as approachable and open and as interesting. So yeah, it's just going to take on new things. And, you know, a couple of years ago, there was, through Movement Generation, there was a liberation permaculture class that happened in Oakland. So working with different nonprofits and communities of color. So yeah, there's a lot of different directions, because permaculture does have some limitations, and it's, I feel like it's growing as a movement, and it's starting to confront some of these things and get out of certain patterns, and or not get out, but like expand, keep going on the great patterns that are growing, but go into new communities and whatever. And, you know, permaculture is a 10,000-year-old cutting-edge technology, and a lot of it's indigenous-based land wisdom. And so, you know, I've been blessed to be able to work with some Native Americans in Oakland on some community farms, the Women's Lodge in East Oakland, I did for a couple of years. So, yeah, there's just lots of different cross-cultural fermentation and pollination that happens in a diverse urban city, which we have all over. And so it's just, yeah, it's really exciting that these kind of things are going to, permaculture is going to take different permutations as it keeps growing and unfolding and developing. So it's definitely a fun thing.
And with your time and experience and all those students who have met you and graduated through your program, which I have to say, you said about 700 people have gone through your program at Merritt College?
Yeah, it's been around for 11 years. We have 25 to 35 students a semester. It's now offered 3 times a year. And there's other classes that have come out of our class. So there's a mushroom class that's a whole class by itself, how to cultivate edible ones and how to identify wild ones. And there's a natural building class that's come out of our class. So I've had guest teachers come in. And then we got when the department had some more money, we were able to, you know, have a new class. And there's a gray water class, and, you know, it just goes on and on. So we're having a whole ecological division, and we've got a 17.5 unit PVC that's recognized by the state of California. And we're going to try to expand it into a 2-year AA degree when we get a little more funding, a little more time. It's nice to have it be legitimized by academic institutions, because it's, permaculture is just all over the place, general unifying theory kind of thing, and academics are more like, hey, we're just going to study one particular strand, you know, just insects or just genetics or just soil. But, you know, it's really an integration, and the landscape hort department's a great place for it. But, you know, it could be in sociology, it could be in architecture, it could be in alternative energy, and there's so many different things that permaculture is. So that's why me, as a vegetable gardener, edible gardener kind of person, landing at the landscape hort department makes sense, but it certainly could be in other departments easily as well. But that we've been there for 10 years and have full classes and lots of enthusiasm and a nice big working farm, people really enjoy it. And it makes sense as one place for permaculture. But I see lots of other places besides just landscape hort, but just getting some credibility to it through institutions does help. So then students take the class and get the
17 and a half units, they have to take other classes, and they get the 17 and a half unit PDC. That, I didn't calculate the hours, but it's probably 10 times the amount of classroom time and fieldwork time that you would get from just a traditional 2-week PDC, and the classes over a 4-month period, so you really get to see some different seasons. That's really a good thing that we have about our program, that, you know, if you take the class starting in January, you end the end of May, and so you go from, in our climate, definitely winter through spring and into summer, just in 4 months. And then there's a 4-week intensive summer class, and then there's a fall class that goes from the end of August to mid-December. So you go from summer to fall to winter. So you really get to see things unfold by going there just once a week, you know, participating in it and seeing it slowly evolve. It's a really wonderful format. So for the people that are really busy, they can take the summer class kind of thing and get the intensive. And the people that are busy working, for more working class folks, every year we have a night class. And then the next year we have a day class. But still, it's just a slow unfolding progression of the class. It's a nice pattern for people to really absorb so much information and get exposed to so many different things and be able to slowly integrate it into their own lives. So it's a really nice format that we've just kind of fallen into.
Sounds like you're doing some pretty incredible work through Merritt College. When you say 700 students, the number just kind of is surprising.
It's over time, so maybe there's 75 students a year, but and sometimes more, sometimes 100 students a year. But
I know that there are distinctions between the East Coast and the West Coast and how people approach things and how necessarily plugged in or in tune folks are, but I follow various PDC courses that are being done independently and hear some of the numbers where it's, you know, we need X number of students to hold the class, and then you find out that that program never happened because they didn't reach the 10 students that they needed. Or, you know, we're going to pull it off for this many students, and then you find out that the actual number of people who committed to the class was half of what they expected. For me, it's just adding up those numbers and knowing some people who have taught 10 PDCs over 4 or 5 years who have only graduated barely triple-digit students through that program.
As a teacher, I would love to have the 9 students a semester kind of thing, but it's just unfortunate what's happening with public education, that it's just an attack on public education is what's been happening. And so in the last 3 years, we were just at a department meeting last night, and we lost the Palazzo Community Colleges. It's the larger community college system that Merritt's a part of. In the East Bay, lost $20 million just from federal cuts and state cuts and whatever. Every community is losing money, and it's just, this is what we're going to be dealing with. But the permaculture classes held fast, and we lost about, I don't know, a third or more of our classes, because if they didn't have 25 people enrolled by the first day, they just got chopped. I have done some experiments. The class had, the department has pushed me a few times, and I've tried it, and twice we've had 60 people in the class, and it's just, because there's a lot of interest in it, but it's just kind of, I can't manage it. It's too big. And so it's a 4-month class too, and people move away, and a lot of people are unemployed, and some people get work or, you know, whatever. Life happens in 4 months, and so there's usually like 25% less than what starts. So, because that's the other thing, that people aren't investing as much money. It's, when I started 11 years ago, it was $20 a unit, and someone was just pointing out, I think it's 45 or maybe even more than that right now, $45 for a unit. So it's a 3-unit class. So it's getting up there. Someone says about $158 is what they're charging for the 3-unit class. And because when I was starting 10, 11 years ago, I'd never taught one. I kind of structured the class where people had to take the course twice to get the PDC from me before I got the 17 and a half unit certificate approved. And so I just left that structure so people can kind of go over the course for a whole year, a whole, you know, 12 months. Well, 4 months and 4 months, really, but just over multiple seasons to see, you know, what you do in the spring, what you do in the fall kind of thing, because they're quite different in our climate. That's how it's evolved. So it's 180 hours is what I require for my PDC. So a regular one is 90. So it definitely has just more time. So we're actually able to do lots of farming as part of it, as well as get the academic intellectual lectures and videos and student design work kind of stuff, as well as, hey, look, we've got a working farm and we're needing to maintain it and put down that straw bale mulch kind of thing and move that horse manure that we're getting for free and plant those fruit tree guilds and help out with the food forest, that kind of stuff. So it's very grounded and something very tangible so people can really grasp it. Like I said, that's why it's a popular class, because people can go home every week with a grocery bag of food or cuttings, or just really the skills is what we try to impart. That, you know, we've got 5,000 square feet of greenhouses that were built in the 70s at Merritt. It was probably 400 or 500 students at Merritt each semester. I'm taking a whole bunch of different classes. So they're able to have access to a tropical greenhouse and a cuttings, the whole mist house and seeds. And so like any kind of permaculture thing, there's abundance of stress. And so students can take things home at the end of the semester. They take things home every week. And so like we're teaching about food forests and whatnot. And oh, look, here's, you know, we've got, I don't know the number, but probably well over 100 comfrey patches on our hillside, and so we divide up just, you know, 4 or 5 of them, and then everybody in the class can take as much comfrey home as they want, kind of thing, because it's just one of these really hands-on kind of thing. And you know, we teach the abundance and generosity. We have a biennial plant sale, and so students help propagate all these really cool plants and have really amazing people that have come together. And now there's paid student interns. There's a science technician, one of my former students, Anders Vidstrand, and he's really been instrumental over the last 5 years or so in making the plant sale much more edible, much more perennial vegetable, much more permaculture oriented. And the sales are getting bigger, and he's volunteered a whole bunch of his time doing it. And then now some of the plant sale money that we generate, it goes for classroom supplies and whatnot, and soil and seeds and plant materials. So a lot of this gets reinvested. But then, you know, the extra plants go on our acre hillside all the time. So we got good abundance of students get it, get a lot of the extra plants, community gardens, church gardens, whatever. Nonprofits get some of the extra stuff from our plant sales. And then now he set it up so some of the students are being the student propagation coordinators. And so they're getting paid to run this plant sale over months. So it's like, hey, we're creating sustainable jobs and just the experience of it. And then they can go off and do their own landscape business, or some of them go off and start farms and, you know, whatever. So it's just like, it's a good incubator. Lots of good possibilities in permaculture, as you know.
I'm glad to know that this course is available. I've received some contact from listeners in California who are looking for PDC programs that would be low cost, no cost, or in some way structured to be affordable. So I'm going to be glad to get this additional information out there about your program at Merritt College. And then if anybody wants to contact you, they can go to your website once that's back up and send you a message from there to find out more, or to network with you and find out about ways that they could get involved.
Yeah, through Wild Heart Gardens. There's an eco house, I didn't really even talk about that, but a demonstration garden to help maintain. They're a 40-year nonprofit that just runs so many projects, the Basil Seed Library and the farmers markets and the curbside recycling, a whole library and whole just great ecology center. So I'm involved with that. And so I have contact and info through there. And like I said, also Merritt College is the way to get in touch with me and just see the diversity of programs that we have. The permaculture design class is not the only one. Lots of other cool ecologically based, very affordable classes. MerrittLandHort.com. So yeah, I'm going to recommend that you guys buy the book, Timber Press. It would be how you look it up, and look out Wild Heart Gardens. I'll have some information about some upcoming speaking tours that I'm going to slowly put together.
I will make sure that there are links to all of this information in the show notes for anybody who downloads the episode and has a listen. Also, anyone who visits my website will be able to see all of this information in the notes for our conversation. The world will get to hear all about the work that you're doing. And if something happens that your book tour brings you to the East Coast, let me know. Maybe I can find out if you're going to be someplace close by, swing by, buy you a pint of whatever your favorite is, whether that is a beer or something without alcohol, and sit down and chat.
Nice, nice. Yeah, I have strong roots to Ann Arbor and lots of family there, so I visit every summer, and I'm going to do a little mini book tour in Ann Arbor, and got some family in the Chicago area, so I'm going to do a small little thing around there this summer, so I'll get some information out to you as it develops.
That'll be great, and I can make sure that I share that with the listeners as well, so that if they'd like to bring a copy of their book out, they can meet you and have a copy signed, or just come and, you know, maybe get an opportunity to discuss a little bit of permaculture with you.
Great. Thanks so much, Scott. I really appreciate it, and really enjoy what you're doing with the Permaculture Podcast. So keep it up. Look forward to giving you suggestions for other wonderful West Coast teachers, because we have a lot of great projects and a lot of great teachers out here, and a lot of permacultures happening that you may not have heard about if you're far across 3,000 miles away, and some really great things. So yeah, in the back of the book, the last chapter of the book has a lot of just different organizations that I thought were worthwhile. And on my website in the future, I'll put a lot more in with this book. There's, you know, we had to have a lot of little small snapshots of a lot of different things. So I wanted to put a lot more of my favorite books in, or my favorite websites, or my favorite, you know, nonprofit kind of things. And, you know, we just got to put a small sampling of lots of things. Anyway, look out for that for some more information.
And thank you for joining me. I really appreciate it. Every conversation that I have with someone who's practicing this material, whether they're an author or a farmer or someone who's just trying to figure out how they're going to make it all work, it makes this permaculture world a little bit smaller, and we all get to hear more voices and understand how each of us makes this work within our own lives. Thank you for your time and sharing all of this with us.
Thanks so much, Scott. Take care.
And that was Christopher Shine. His love of this material and his knowledge of so many places, practitioners, and possibilities really comes through, doesn't it? His involvement in so much makes him a wealth of information. And he and I talked about many, many things that didn't make it into the interview. But, like so many things, that's a story for another time. As for the book, and the preprint version I read, as I said, I liked it. The material is general, approachable, and easy to read in a way many other permaculture books are not. If we place some of the books already on the market on a scale of 1 to 10, as an introduction to permaculture, with the designer's manual at the upper end at 10, Holmgren's Permaculture Principles and Pathways at 7, Hemingway's Gaia's Garden at, say, 5, and Peter Bain's The Permaculture Handbook at 3 on this scale, I put Christopher Shine's The Vegetable Gardener's Guide to Permaculture firmly at 1. And that's the place we need a book on permaculture. This isn't for the professional designer or even someone who's read the other titles mentioned. This is a book to give to the masses to start their way down the road of ecological design, to have on hand when talking before garden clubs or civic groups, or to give to my father when he asks me again what it is I do with my life. Why do I say that? Because this is a coffee table style book. It's full of gorgeous pictures. There's a mixture of gardening and integrated design ideas. Simple takeaway projects someone can try that aren't intimidating, expensive, or time-consuming. Plant lists that I dare to say most people have heard of, that don't delve into some of the off-the-beaten-path perennials that we're currently cultivating to use as vegetables. There are ways to adapt the information to different climates. The overview of design lacks jargon or other inaccessible language, all while still keeping permaculture at the core. And through it all, what I think really ties this book together and makes it such a wonderful piece is the personal story and journey that Christopher shares with us that he went through in order to arrive at this place, that allows the reader to relate to him and his position in the world by removing the technical and including so much of the human. As you heard Christopher himself say in working with his publisher and co-author, a lot of work went into getting these results. But I feel it's an overwhelming success and a worthy addition to a beginner's library. If you're listening to this episode as one of your earliest exposures to permaculture, buy this book. If you know permaculture and one way to share it with someone else, or you're familiar with permaculture, but when you read some of the other books, you just shake your head and going, I don't really get this, pick up a copy of Christopher's book. It's the right place for them or you to start. Also, Christopher and I spoke about having him return to discuss earning a living as a professional designer, because his design work, even though we talked largely about his role as a teacher, is where he earns his living. he's made a go at it, and he's making a living by doing permaculture design, not by teaching. So if you have any questions for Christopher for that follow-up conversation on that subject, send me an email, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or call the voicemail line, 717-827-6266. The next episode coming up is my follow-up on offering an online PDC with my expanded thoughts and the direction that I want to go with that. Then an interview with Lisa Fernandez, who Eric Tonesmeyer mentioned in our conversation on financial permaculture, and she and I will be talking about local foods and healthy, sustainable food systems. I'm also working out the logistics of talking with Dan Kittredge again, after a few hiccups on my end, to get him back on the show. So that's what you can expect over the next week or two, which doesn't include all the things in the works behind the scenes. Our world of permaculture podcasts grow and expands. It's such a lovely thing, isn't it? I hope you'll join me again soon for those and many others into the future. In the meantime, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.